Israeli occupation of the Palestinian territories since 1967. Over the 6 days of the public hearings, 52 nations and the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, the Arab League and African Union presented their arguments to the court. The first to speak on the final day of the ICJ hearings was the Turkish representative, who joined a large number of nations condemning Israel's decades-long brutal policies in the Palestinian territories. Ankara pointed the finger at those nations which won't stop supporting Tel Aviv, despite 30,000 innocent people have been killed in the Gaza Strip.
Those who should do it are well known. The Israeli supporters in the Security Council, it is their responsibility. Indeed, most of the international community is aware of this injustice and is trying to do something.
Palestinian representatives opened the proceedings on Monday last week by accusing Israel of having subjected Palestinians to decades of discrimination, leaving them with the choice of displacement, subjugation, or death. 2 days later, the UK asked the court not to offer an opinion at all on the legal consequences of Israel's occupation.
Unfortunately, the UK came with the political arguments, and here we are in a legal body. Unfortunately, their legal argument was very weak, and we believe that the court will dismiss it. The Israeli practices and measures and its presence in the occupied Palestinian territory is unlawful, and unlawfulness should have consequences.
This ICJ case was prompted by the UN General Assembly in December 2022, and it is different from another ICJ case filed by South Africa, which has accused Israel of genocide in Gaza. Outside the court, activists showed their support to besieged Palestinians during all days of proceedings.
There's also not an excuse for the other countries to say, well, we are not complying with this legal system that we all agreed upon.
I'm here to just show the support, to say to the whole world that the genocide should stop, and this is the only way actually to support our people in Palestine, in Gaza.
The court is expected to issue its advisory opinion on Israel's occupation of the Palestinian territories within 6 months. Despite having no binding force, the court's opinions nevertheless carry great legal weight and moral authority. However, it must be said, the ICJ has no enforcement arm. Max Civili, The Hague.
Repair operations in the final stages. This is the main distribution pipeline passing through Iran's southwestern province of Charmahal and Bakhtiari, responsible for delivering natural gas to the northern provinces of Iran. Part of the main pipeline hit by two explosions on February 14. Clearly, the saboteurs had picked this remote location, hoping that it would result in delayed emergency response, leading to vast natural gas outages in the country. An obvious miscalculation, as the National Iranian Gas Company, NIGC, had its local technicians and first responders on site in less than 10 minutes. The tall flames resulting from the overnight explosion could be seen from miles away.
The explosion was immense, creating a huge fire that burned and melted everything on its way 300 meters away.
Power cables were damaged. The local electricity distribution company immediately diverted to other connected paths to prevent power outages. And within minutes, local NIGC technicians arrived.
As a result of great teamwork, we were able to contain the fire in less than 5 hours, and we completed our repair operation within 44 hours, which can be considered a record. It is important to note that our local technicians were able to quickly bring the situation under control without any help from nearby provinces. That is why there were no disruptions in gas supplies.
As a result of the NIGC's agile response, the sabotage attack did not lead to any natural gas outages.
So the pipe that was damaged by the explosion, a pipe that would carry 70 million cubic meters of natural gas in 24 hours.
The NIGC had two separate alternative options. So as a first step, technicians simply cut gas flow through this pipe, which allowed the first responders to contain the fire in less than 5 hours.
Throughout the year, we carry out several simulation exercises with different scenarios to enhance our response plans and procedures for all kinds of hazards. That is why our team is always prepared for emergencies, and in this case, they knew exactly what to do according to our crisis management plan.
With the damaged pipe replaced with a new one, everything is back to normal.
This heavily damaged 42-inch pipe that you see right behind me is part of the main pipeline that takes natural gas from the south of Iran towards the north. However, the NIGC did have a plan B, and therefore the explosion did not disrupt gas supplies.
Officials detailed that because the fire sparked in an unpopulated area, the spread of the flames was manageable for the responding firefighters. There were no casualties and only limited material damage. And since the flow of heat and cooking gas to the northern provinces was not disrupted, as far as consumers were concerned, basically nothing happened. Simply a foiled attempt, with Iranians now more confident than ever in the capabilities of NIGC technicians. Gisumish Ahmadi, Borujan.
No picket lines over the weekend, but the strike action is on. Thousands of National Health Service junior doctors, who form half of the doctors' workforce in England, walk off the job. Their demands the same as the last time we talked to them.
Because of this erosion of pay over all this time, we've been seeing problems with staff recruitment and retention, and we've been hemorrhaging people either out of medicine completely or to other countries that are willing to recruit us and pay us basically the rates we were being paid 15 years ago. And so the message from the BMA has always been to try and get that pay back to 2008 levels.
In other words, a 35% pay rise to make up for previous below-inflation pay rises. An extra 3% on top of the average of nearly 9% received last year was being discussed before talks between the government and the BMA, the trade union for doctors, broke down in December. But the walkouts come at a cost. They're happening at a critical time of year when hospitals are especially busy dealing with the challenges of the cold season and with an NHS waiting list at a staggering 7.6 million. Over 1.3 million hospital appointments had to be rescheduled since the industrial action began over a year ago. And yet, the striking doctors continue to enjoy the support of over half of Britons.
The doctors say they're doing this to bring the government back to the negotiating table and to get it to recognize their value. They're also saying that feeling undervalued and being underpaid is pushing them to seek jobs abroad.
The BMA says 4 in 10 doctors plan to leave the NHS at the first opportunity. The government says it won't negotiate while the strikes are ongoing.
There's an overall focus on privatization, which means the health care insurance companies will be taking over many aspects of the running and resources of health. And that's led to record low wages, especially compared to a massive inflation and cost of living crisis, so that it no longer justifies the cost of training. In terms of the actual remuneration, medical students are leaving with medical school with £100,000 worth of debt, and they're not looking to pay that off for well over a decade. Whereas if they go to other countries, simply next door, Ireland or Australia, they can immediately double their wage.
The British government seems nowhere near loosening its purse strings. But the consensus is that the longer these strikes grind on, the wider the damage. Saipur is up, London.
The summit of ECOWAS leaders, which ended in Abuja, the Nigerian capital, resolved that closure of air and land borders between ECOWAS countries and Niger is to be lifted in addition to other sanctions.
No-fly zone of all commercial flights to and from Niger is to be lifted. Suspension of all commercial and financial transactions between ECOWAS member states and Niger is to be lifted. Freezing of all service transactions, including utility services, is to be lifted. Freezing of assets of the Republic of Niger in ECOWAS central banks is to be lifted.
However, the ECOWAS meeting called for the ruling authority in Niger to provide an acceptable transition timetable to constitutional order. The ECOWAS leader said the decision to lift the sanctions was based on humanitarian considerations, especially as people are in the month of Lent and the holy month of Ramadan approaches. The meeting asked the three countries that exited the ECOWAS, that are Niger, Burkina Faso, and Mali, to reconsider the decisions in view of the benefits the countries and their citizens enjoy in the regional bloc, especially the hundreds of millions of dollars of projects and programs, notably the Food Security Reserve. The ECOWAS leaders therefore urged the three member states that exited the regional body to resort to dialogue, negotiation and mediation to address their concerns.
The authority has also instructed the president of the commission to invite Burkina Faso, Niger, Mali and Guinea to attend the technical and consultative meetings of ECOWAS, as well as all security-related meetings.
The three West African countries exited the ECOWAS and established what they call the Sahel Alliance after ECOWAS resolved to condemn the military coups in the three countries and to impose sanctions on them. Experts believe that there are solutions in the medium and long terms for solving the crisis in the regional economic body.
The issues I mentioned earlier of pan-Africanism, of resource nationalism, of ensuring that people are carried along in decision-making processes, of ensuring that there is equitable distribution of resources, of ensuring that people have access to the good things of life, of ensuring that the dividends of governance is brought to the people, must be addressed.
As one of the least developed regions in the world, the Sahel faces a multitude of challenges, including poverty, food security, poor governance and insecurity. Experts say some of these challenges are a matter of great concern, not just for the Sahel, but for the whole of Africa and beyond. They also noted that skillful diplomacy must be employed in addressing the exit of the three West African regions from the ECOWAS. Danjuma Abdullahi, Abuja.
Iran Zamzam's company is poised to replace two major international soft drink brands in the region, driven by a growing boycott sentiment against Israeli army-associated products following the Gaza conflict. Having already entered markets in Kuwait, Bahrain, Qatar, and the UAE, the company aims to export 4 million cans of its popular soda to Kuwait, making a significant milestone in its expansion efforts.
My concept revolved around organizing a festival exclusively showcasing Iranian products. However, following the conflict in Gaza and the overwhelming positive feedback we received, we expanded our vision to encompass Turkish and Kuwaiti products as well. The event is spanned 2 months, during which we received numerous requests for an extension. Our primary objective at the society remains to spotlight Iranian, Kuwaiti, and Turkish goods, particularly as consumers are actively seeking alternatives to products associated with Israel.
Zamzam's growth in the Persian Gulf soft drink market is reinforced by its official replacement status for soda drinks in Kuwait alongside local brands like LC and Kenzo. The Iranian-Turkish festival organized by the biggest societies in Kuwait, Al Jabriya, has been instrumental in promoting Zamzam and other locally made alternatives as primary substitutes for boycotted products, significantly boosting Zamzam's popularity and market presence in Kuwait.
We're also operating as a retail seller, catering to the demand for products from Iran, Turkey and Kuwait, which many customers have been requesting. While we understand that implementing boycotts can be challenging to achieve rapidly, it's not unattainable.
Therefore, in response to the tragic events in Gaza, we've completely redirected our focus towards promoting locally made products through a campaign titled Support Us to Ice. The response has been phenomenal, with our sales soaring. Moreover, numerous other societies in Kuwait have chosen to follow suit and advocate exclusively for Iranian, Turkish, and locally produced goods.
The shift in consumer preference toward locally produced alternatives like Zamzam is emblematic of the broader economic repercussions of the conflict in Gaza. Major multinational corporations, including Starbucks, McDonald's, and Pepsi Cola, have experienced a significant decline in sales as consumers increasingly opt for products that align with their values and principles. As Zamzam continues to expand its footprint in the GCC countries, particularly in Kuwait, there is a shift in consumer behavior toward more regional products, and particularly the one from Iran, from other GCC countries, which is why the public in Kuwait is shifting into buying more products that are not associated in any way possible with the United States or Britain. This is Farah Al-Hashim, Kuwait City, from Al Jabriya area.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
Supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee. So recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday five things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that Thou makest me secure in the places of fear through Thy security. and placest me in thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household, and make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profits on the day of resurrection. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hezbollah has targeted an aerial surveillance base in the Upper Galilee region with 40 rockets, and this target being deeper inside the occupied territories this time. The attack was in response to the Monday Israeli strike on the Lebanese city of Baalbek that left two civilians dead. The resistance group has also shot down an Israeli drone over southern Lebanon. Hezbollah and Israel have been engaged in clashes since the Israeli regime launched its genocidal war on Gaza in early October. Meantime, truce talks are also ongoing in the Qatari capital over the genocidal war on Gaza. So what's the future holding for Gaza? What is the Hezbollah-Israeli conflict heading for? Welcome to The Spotlight. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi, and these are our guests in this edition of the program. Elijah Magni, your journalist and political analyst, is joining us from Brussels. Also with us will be Merhaba Osman, journalist, public analyst, and host of Press TV's mainstream program out of Beirut.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Let me welcome both my guests to the show, beginning with Elijah. This genocidal war that the Israeli regime has waged, Elijah, on Gaza, has impacted the region. It has kind of a spread. You know that resistance fighters have not been sitting idle by. They have been performing their own retaliatory operations. Now, we're talking about Hezbollah in this episode more. Hezbollah is one of them, and it seems that some analysts maintain that even if the war in Gaza stops, the tension between Tel Aviv and Hezbollah could linger on. Do you agree with that? And if so, where could that end up in?
Thank you for having me.
Sure.
I'm not sure that Israel can afford to see the war continuing on the Lebanese borders because of the Hezbollah capability that has manifested in the last 4.5 months. And we have seen how Hezbollah gradually used sophisticated missiles, drones, heavy rockets, and proved the capability of selecting specific and precise military targets all along the 100 to 110 kilometers all along the Lebanese borders. Moreover, we have seen also drones going more than 90 kilometers inside Palestine, bypassing even Haifa And we have seen how the Hezbollah bombarded the Golan Heights, Safad, and other targets, showing that it can keep up with the Israeli challenge. However, what has been introduced recently was the anti-air missiles that drove the Israeli totally out of their balance when the drone, the Hermes 450, that can fly up to 20,000 feet, was downed by the Hezbollahi anti-air unit. This is why Hezbollah is showing its military capability and is hiding even much more. The meant that Hezbollah started the war, and Hezbollah is saying that is ready to shit. Israelis are only saying that they will continue if the diplomatic mediation has failed or will fail in convincing Hezbollah to stop the war. Therefore, it is always conditioned with an element that the Israelis are making sure they offer it to the audience that they really don't want to engage in all-out war immediately and have only this option, even if they have instructed their people that the war will last until the beginning of the month of August.
Okay. Now, Marwa, of course, there is this division among the Israeli officials. We know about that. And we have some radical one, the Israeli war minister, Yoav Gallant, saying that there will be no decline, in his words, in Israeli action against Hezbollah, even if the ceasefire is agreed upon in Gaza. And we'll talk about the ceasefire later in the show. So do you share the same view as Elijah?
I share nothing as Elijah, and Elijah knows very well why I share nothing as Elijah. I didn't know that he will be here. If I knew that he will be here, I wouldn't have accepted the invitation. But anyhow, since I am a daughter of Press TV and a worker at Press TV at the same time, and being as a guest today, not as part of Press TV, I'll continue out of respect for the producer who had me here but did not tell me that this will be the second guest. And as you know, Behrouz, I cannot just stay calm about anything in my life. And this is one of the stances that I should say that apparently your second guest now finds it possible to be on Press TV after years of being very critical against Hezbollah, Press TV, the Axis of Resistance. I'm really surprised he's here. Anyways, talking about...
Stick to the point, please.
Yeah, I will get to the point. Talking about what is happening, especially what Yoav Gallant said, I think you've heard Yoav Gallant say the same thing in the first ceasefire that was announced in the war on Gaza. I think it was the first, after the first month and a half. And I think that it was not necessarily a message towards his own people as much as it was some sort of a message towards the internal Lebanese society by trying to threaten them not to go back to their houses in the event that there was a ceasefire announced, because even if a ceasefire gets hold of Lebanon as well after it gets hold of Gaza, the Zionist Israeli settlers will not go back to their settlements. And the reason why is that they have made it clear that they will not go back even if a ceasefire is made with Lebanon, because they don't feel safe. This is what they are saying. So Yoav Gallant is trying somehow to keep also the Lebanese border out of, keeping the Lebanese people out of the Lebanese border as well, because he knows very well, even if the ceasefire takes place, the Israeli settlers are not going back, because they are demanding a conclusive truce, some sort of a peace plan with Lebanon, or else they will not return. And we have heard a lot of issues being discussed about this matter over the fact that there are some political people being sent to intermediate in Lebanon, especially from the United States of America, telling Hezbollah that there might be some sort of a political solution that they might reach with the Zionist entity, a political one rather than a military one. And Hezbollah said that, repeats what they keep saying, repeats what we heard Said Hassan Nasrallah say since the beginning of the war on Gaza up until now, that Hezbollah will stop when the war on Gaza stops. And Said Hassan Nasrallah, in his last speech, he made it clear that in the event of a ceasefire in Gaza, Hezbollah will stop fire. But if the Zionist entity continues to fire, Hezbollah will fire equally in a deterrent manner, the same manner that we have been seeing. Yes, it has been escalating, but at a very, very slow pace. But at the end of the day, it is being confined to certain areas, to certain targets, and not getting involved, for example, with the capital or with major residential areas, despite the fact that Zionist Israel always bombards residential areas and claims that it is targeting Hezbollah depots, when in reality, and after the Lebanese authorities investigate, they find that they are either privately owned companies or residential areas where literal Lebanese civilians were just living with their families there.
Okay. Now, Elijah, Lebanese resistance fighters, you know, they've mainly targeted Israeli military positions, but you see that the Israeli regime has targeted residential areas in Lebanon and causing the death of a number of civilians there. So it's not only the Gaza Strip that you see this. Tel Aviv's disregard is everywhere for civilian lives, no matter where. Now you see this also noticeable in Lebanon.
Because Israelis are careless about civilian lives, we have seen how little importance they give to the Geneva Convention and to the international laws in Gaza. They have done that in the past against Lebanon in the many previous wars. This is why it is not surprising when we see the Israelis trying to target the Lebanese civilians and trying to drag Hezbollah into a wider war. This is something that Hezbollah is very conscientious about, and this is why Hezbollah is limiting always the fight and the war in support of Gaza, so the Palestinian cause is always in the center of attention, and bringing back the Israelis to the same rules of engagement and imposing deterrence on the Israelis, even if sometimes what the Israelis do is quite painful when they kill civilians that are supposed to be spared. But at the end of the day, the world is dealing with the most immoral army in the world, and we have seen how the Israelis are behaving, have behaved in the past, and are behaving today in Palestine. So I am not surprised to see this behavior of the Israelis and trying always to hit those who are the weakest in any war.
Right. And Marwa, lots of people have been displaced from both sides of the border, especially from the Israeli side. Thousands of people have been displaced in this exchange of fire between the two sides, Hezbollah and the IOF. And I remember Hezbollah chief warning the Tel Aviv regime just recently, maybe a couple of weeks back, that if they take further steps and if they move toward further escalation, Hezbollah will do something so that the, you know, Israelis have to be actually forced to evacuate maybe 2 million Israelis close to the border. So I want to ask you, would you expect this in any way to turn into a full-fledged war? And if that happens, who would be the loser at the end of the day?
Behrouz, I think the only option that this might end up being a full-fledged war is directly related to the preliminary results of the U.S. elections. It has nothing to do whatsoever with what the Israelis want or can do, because if it's only about the Israeli capability, it is definitely a no. The answer to your question would be a no. But we have to look at it from a wider angle. If the Biden administration is not going to be able to stop Donald Trump from returning to power, I think the U.S. might go ahead and, in order to try and use Code 606 for their own country, which means stopping the elections because of a major war that might take place that would end up having the United States of America get involved, then yes, the answer to your question would be yes. But at the moment, reading what's happening, looking at the regional politics, the international politics, and the U.S. politics, and also diving into the internal Israeli politics, when you see how the protests against Netanyahu and the war cabinet in general is escalating, people are going back to the streets, same as they did before the war, because if you remember, they were in the streets for like 54 to 56 weeks trying to get rid of the Netanyahu government because of the reform plan that they wanted to impose on their judicial system. Now we are seeing a return to the protests, not with the same intensity, but it is being said that in the event that a ceasefire happens, we will see protests in the streets the same way we did before. So that's a more pressure on the Israeli government to stop the war. So if it is only according to the variables that are found inside of the Israeli entity, the answer is definitely not.
Okay. Now, Elijah, let's now take a glance at the situation in the Gaza Strip and related developments there. Qatari Foreign Ministry spokesman Majid Al-Ansari says that Doha is optimistic that a deal on a ceasefire will be achieved before Ramadan. And also we have U.S. President Joe Biden hoping that this will happen by next Monday. But Hamas, speaking of some big gaps to be bridged before a deal is reached, is a deal around the corner, in your opinion?
I think the ceasefire is something that everybody wants at the moment. But what Benjamin Netanyahu is trying to do is to bring a goat in a farm at the last moment. Because he feels in a strong position, and he feels by starving the population, by continuing the bombardment in Gaza, even if he has not achieved any of the declared objectives at the beginning of the war, he can twist the arms of the Palestinian resistance because he doesn't care about the 136 Israeli prisoners. So what he's trying to do is he's trying to accommodate the American pressure, at the same time the families of the prisoners, by releasing a small number. There have been a talk about 40 prisoners to be released in exchange of a certain number of Palestinian prisoners that has not been agreed upon yet. But at the same time, it is important to keep the Muslims away from fighting during the month of Ramadan. That will end also by the beginning of the Jewish feast that would last for 7 days on the 22nd of April. So this kind of combination, it is a suitable for the Israelis and for the Palestinians to breathe a little bit and to have less bombardment on a daily basis against the civilians, allow the civilians to go and see what happened to their beloved one, or if they can find something still standing, or perhaps have more humanitarian aid, because the Israel has been violating the ICJ order and the international laws, and committing war crimes and crimes against humanity by denying the population the basic service, a basic need to survive, and denying them water, food, and electricity. So for that, I think the problem are the details of the deal, and Netanyahu is trying to squeeze as much as possible to give less concession and to offer himself as a good negotiator to his people, and at the same time plan to continue the war on Gaza after the ceasefire.
Now, Marwan, you know that Netanyahu has also threatened to launch this military assault on Rafah, and you know what the situation is in Rafah like. More than a million Palestinians have been forced into displacement there, and some of them are being starved to death, another weapon that, unfortunately, Israel is using, apart from all those, you know, U.S.-made weapons and all that that they are using against them. They're also being starved to death, dying of some preventable diseases. So Netanyahu is just saying that the attack on Rafah will happen, definitely, that's for sure, and a possible ceasefire deal would only postpone it. So let's have your assessment of the situation.
I think that he means it, and I think that the Biden administration, despite the fact that they keep saying that they don't like it, they would see a catastrophe coming out of it, or that they have many times asked the Israeli entity not to harm any civilians while the Rafah operation is underway. They did not tell the Israeli entity they're not allowed to initiate any sort of ground invasion or air invasion against Rafah, which means that the United States of America actually gave the green light for such a horrific operation that might end up in a second phase of the genocide that we witnessed before, and we are still witnessing massacres that come out of this genocide. So I think that if there is something that would stop Netanyahu, it would have to be some sort of internal pressure, or elevated resistance coming from Palestine in specific and the axis of resistance by default. But if Netanyahu is to break that ceasefire, which is also a possibility because we saw how the first part of the Paris talks just went down the drain because Netanyahu felt like it and decided that he wants to finish off with Khan Yunis and probably start something in Rafah, but was then stopped by the Americans for the sole purpose of approaching Ramadan and what Ramadan means, the holy month of Ramadan means for all Muslims and especially the Muslims of Palestine who would go and pray in Al-Aqsa and not allowing them or continuing the genocide during the month would only elevate and escalate the situation against the entire axis of resistance. But in case Netanyahu decides to break the ceasefire or wait till until the ceasefire, which is supposedly according to certain sources coming from Egypt and Qatar, that it would be around 45 to 50 days, if he's going to wait 45 to 50 days and then relaunch that attack on Rafah, I think the first thing that he would be doing is pushing the current displaced people, the refugees in Rafah, either to Gaza or northern than that, but under the condition that he's been stating several times right now, whether in the Zionist media or elsewhere, that he will not allow men to go with the women and the children and the elderly. So I think what we saw in the northern part of Gaza, where the Israeli entity occupation forces entered forcefully with Merkava and whatnot to basically just incarcerate everyone there, including the paramedics and the doctors and the nurses and everyone involved in helping, directly helping the civilians, will happen again in Rafah, and he might take advantage of this 40 to 50 days truce to maybe let off some of the civilians who will either accept going back to the north under certain conditions or completely leaving into the Sinai desert. And either way, it's a catastrophe. Okay. It's a second Nakba for the Palestinian people.
Okay, Elijah, how do you look at this? What's going to become of Rafah?
I don't think the Israelis can afford not to occupy Rafah because Benjamin Netanyahu have said already that he has still four Hamas battalions to deal with in the area of Rafah. However, he needs to look after the 1979 Camp David agreement with the Egyptians because he's not allowed to put more than four battalions on the borders with Egypt. That will require a lot of effort, international effort and pressure from the Americans. Nevertheless, the resistance can never be defeated because we have seen how he claimed to have occupied the north and occupied the middle, but occupying is something and controlling something else. The resistance is still bombarding the Israeli settlement from the north. The Israelis are still bombing the north with artillery and airplane, which means that there is a still significant resistance in the north, and he is still engaged in Khan Yunis. Therefore, everything he's saying is just to keep the battle as long as possible, allowing him to sort out his domestic affairs and make sure that there is no strong appetite for a very early election where he is going to be accountable for all the mistakes that he did according to the Israeli society on the 7th of October and also the corruption charges. Therefore, it is not a promenade that he's going to go to Rafah because the Palestinian resistance is still strong. Moreover, the international community, although they are finding excuses for Israel, saying you need to displace 1.5 million internally displaced Palestinians from Rafah, it is not that easy to send an army operating on the ground with so many civilians around, even if he doesn't care a lot about civilians. So between what he's saying and what he can do, there is still a huge gap, and this is why the ceasefire will allow him to reorganize himself, or perhaps something new can be presented during the time of the ceasefire when longer negotiation can be presented and available, and that can relieve both sides.
Okay, that's all the time we have. Let me thank my guests, Elijah Magnier, journalist and political analyst in Brussels, Marwa Osman, journalist, political analyst, and my colleague in Beirut.
from east to west. Throughout the vast land of Iran, you're listening to IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
A record number of children and young people in England are seeking help for mental health problems. We take a look at some of the press and world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. According to data laying bare the impact of lengthy waiting lists for regular National Health Service treatment, the number of children referred to emergency mental health care in England has soared by more than 50% in 3 years. Analysis of official data by the Royal College of Psychiatrists revealed there were 32,521 emergency and urgent referrals to child and adolescent mental health services crisis teams in 2022-2023. In 2019-2020, the year before the COVID pandemic, the figure was 21,242. The increase means more than 600 mentally ill children a week are deteriorating to such a state that they need reach a crisis point. The college said many of the children requiring emergency care, some suicidal or seriously ill as a result of eating disorders, have been stuck on waiting lists for an average of 5 months, and in the worst cases, as long as 2 years. British MPs and health leaders said the National Health Service figures exposed a devastating explosion of untreated severe mental ill health among children and should be a wake-up call for the government. They added there was now a serious risk that the alarming surge in children reaching crisis point before being able to access help was becoming the new norm. The president of the Royal College of Psychiatrists, Dr. Lade Smith, told The Guardian no one should have to watch their child's mental health deteriorate while they wait for care, adding, "It's completely unacceptable that this is the reality facing so many families." Dr. Lade Smith said ministers must take urgent action to provide targeted support to every child in need of mental health care and turn the tide on the country's growing children's mental health crisis. She added, "We want to provide young people with effective care as soon as they need it, not once they've already developed a serious illness which could have been prevented. That's why we need to see government focus on prevention and reversing the rising rates of mental illness, as well as ensuring sufficient resources of specialist services." The British newspaper The Sun has also covered the same story and tells us more. Record numbers of children and young people in England are seeking help for mental health problems. In 2022 alone, 1.4 million were referred to child and adolescent mental health services for treatment of anxiety, depression, eating disorders and other psychological problems. But as demand soars for children's mental health care and support, the child and adolescent mental health services teams are struggling to see or treat children quickly enough. Experts say that is leading to thousands of under-18s getting even sicker while on waiting lists, prompting a 53% rise in emergency and urgent referrals for child and adolescent mental health services crisis care. An emergency referral is normally made if a child needs to be seen within 24 hours. Experts say they might be at risk to themselves due to suicidal feelings, have a significant health risk because of an illness such as anorexia, or have another serious mental health condition. Emergency referrals to child and adolescent mental health services are mostly made by general practitioners and doctors in accidents and emergency departments, which are seeing rising numbers of mentally ill children arrive with nowhere else to turn, although schools and social services can also do so. Dr. Elaine Lockhart, the chair of the college's child and adolescent faculty, said, "It's unacceptable that so many children and young people are reaching crisis point before they're able to access care. We cannot allow this to become the new norm." Dr. Elaine Lockhart said, "Severe mental illness is not just an adult problem. The need for specialist mental health services for children and young people is growing all the time." She added, "Many of the conditions arising in children could be prevented or treated if prompt support and access to care were available." Dr. Elaine Lockhart noted, "The evidence shows us that children who receive support quickly are less likely to develop long-term conditions that negatively affect their education, social development, and health in later life. Government and integrated care boards must commit to reducing the rate of mental illness among children by setting an achievable target. This needs to be backed by an expansion of the mental health workforce and additional funding for services." The college welcomed last year's government announcement of an extra £5 million to improve access to early support hubs for people aged between 11 and 25, but it said an extra £125 million to £205 million would be needed to establish hubs in every local authority, with running costs of at least £114 million a year. Laura Bunt, the chief executive of Young Minds, a child's mental health charity, said, "Every young person should be able to access the help they need when they need it. The government must prioritize young people's mental health and make it much easier for them to get support." Daisy Cooper, MP, the Liberal Democrat health spokesperson, said, "This devastating explosion of mental ill health among children should be a wake-up call for the government. Conservative ministers have neglected children's mental health during and after the pandemic, leaving mental health services and families in crisis." The British newspaper The Guardian has also covered the same story. A charity cautioned a worrying number of people taking time off work due to poor mental health leaves the United Kingdom at risk of becoming a burnt-out nation. The head of Mental Health UK has suggested global issues such as climate change and artificial intelligence fueling feelings of hopelessness could be contributing to burnout. It comes after a survey revealed more than a third of adults faced extreme pressure in the workplace in the past year. The YouGov opinion poll of 2,060 adults, 1,132 of whom were workers, found 35% had experienced high or extreme levels of pressure at work, with 20% requiring time off due to poor mental health caused by stress in the past year. Mental Health UK's chief executive, Brian Dow, warned the United Kingdom was rapidly becoming a burnt-out nation, with a worrying number of people taking time off work due to poor mental health caused by stress. He added, "High levels of work absence due to poor mental health are a major challenge, but its causes are complex." He continued by saying, "Public attitudes and understanding towards mental health and work have changed, particularly as the workplace transformed overnight in response to the pandemic." Dow stated, "Meanwhile, we live in unprecedented times and life outside of work has become increasingly difficult due to the cost of living crisis and pressures on public services. While global challenges such as climate change and artificial intelligence fuel stress, anxiety, and feelings of hopelessness." Liptau called on the government to intervene and better support the workforce. He advocated for a national conversation on the issue. Mental Health UK urged Prime Minister Rishi Sunak to hold a national summit to bring together ministers, employers and experts in an effort to create healthy workplace and better support for workers.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.